Well, hello everyone. Thanks again for downloading the podcast. This is our first one of the new year. So again, as I promised last year, we'll try and keep this a little bit more fluid and try to have a few more guests on a weekly or at least bi-weekly basis, depending on how lazy I decide to be. But welcome to episode 40. And this is another so-called Quantum Field Report. This is about the Quantum Information Processing Conference, QIP, that was held last week in Delft in the Netherlands, which is arguably turned into the largest quantum computing and quantum information processing conference in the world. So I'm glad to be joined today by two students from the UK, Joshka Rofe from Durham and Parek Kalpin from UCL, who are both involved in quantum computing research, quantum technology research, and who attended QIP last week. So I'm delighted to have them on, and thanks, guys, for joining me.
You're welcome. Hi.
Yeah, welcome. Happy to be here.
So usually we usually start this off by allowing people to have a little bit of a bio about basically how they came into quantum, more so what sort of, especially since you guys are students, what enticed you to go down this route of studying quantum technology. So Joshka, if you want to maybe try and start off.
Yeah, okay. Well, when I started my undergraduate degree about 5 years ago, or maybe 6 years ago now, I was interested in sort of the technological applications of physics and idea that when you study physics, you're sort of working on the underlying science that will underpin technologies 100 years from now or so. So I was initially interested in fusion research. And then as I progressed through my undergraduate degree, I learned about other technologies, quantum computing being one of them, and I thought it was really cool. So this culminated in me doing a master's project in open quantum systems. And then I applied for a PhD here in Durham. So that's what I've been doing since.
So, I mean, what's your primary area of focus? I mean, I must admit I've been lazy. I haven't done a huge bio search on you guys. I mean, your experimental theory, information theory, foundations. So what's kind of your interest at the moment?
So I work on quantum computing theory, specifically quantum error correction. Yeah, this is what I've been, my main focus in my research for the past 2 years has been on. So the idea behind quantum error correction is that quantum bits compared to, or qubits compared to classical bits are much more faulty and much more prone to error. So the sort of first layer of software that you have to incorporate into a quantum computer is some sort of scheme to detect and correct errors. So I work on protocols to enable you to do that.
And I mean, you're obviously being part of quantum error correction, which is wonderful. This is something out of my own heart. You're certainly interested in sort of the large scale applications, the large scale design of these architectures.
Do you mean in terms of putting together a quantum computer?
Yeah, so I mean, certainly a lot of error correction research is to a certain extent abstract, which is certainly something that we need. Versus people who are more so, you know, similar to my kind of work, which is the more abstract stuff somebody else can figure out, and then it's about implementation and what's efficient and what's viable for something we can build.
Well, absolutely. So, yes, as you said, a lot of the work going into quantum error correction is sort of working towards quantum computers, or working towards the schemes that will be put on the quantum computers in 10 to 20 years, but there are also some interesting things to be done with the quantum computers that are being built now. So, like, one of the first milestones in actually building a quantum computer will to be achieve one logical qubit, so to have one encoded piece of information or quantum piece of information on a computer that's there for a reliable amount of time. So yeah, there are interesting things to be looked at in the short term and the long term.
Wonderful. So, I mean, Parry, how about yourself? I mean, how did you get into this? Was it something that was already of interest to you when you sort of started undergrad and when they were looking for grad projects, or was it sort of something that came as a bit of a surprise after you figured out what it was?
Yeah, this was a field that I knew nothing about coming into my undergraduate. So my focus really in like I would say a lot of people come into a physics degree looking at one of two areas, which is either astrophysics or particle physics, and I was very much interested in the latter. So I was pretty laser focused on going into that field, and that was the kind of the area that I did my undergraduate research project in as well. But during my undergrad during my degree, which is at Imperial College, I took a chance. Basically, I took a chance place summer research placement in a slightly different field. I was working with in something. Basically, it was I was doing a small project on stochastic simulations, and I happened to be based up on the same floor as the controlled quantum dynamics group at Imperial College, which I think had been running a CDT for a couple of years there. And when I was up on that floor, just kind of as a sort of just an undergraduate doing this summer research project, I got chatting to the people up there, and they introduced me to this field of quantum information and quantum computing, which I absolutely never heard of before. And so it was sort of coming back after doing a year abroad as part of my degree and choosing my final year options. I took two courses, one in kind of foundations of quantum mechanics from Terry Rudolph, and one in quantum information. And through those two sort of courses, I basically fell in love with the field and realized that it was actually much more interesting to me. It also kind of played on, I was interested in, I had a, I would, I was interested in computation and learning to code and as a hobby. And this kind of like allowed, I felt like this field kind of allowed me to mix these two interests I had of computing with physics. And as a result, basically realizing this is what I wanted to do, but also realizing that I didn't have much research experience, I ended up finding this CDT program at UCL, which kind of gave me the chance to do a master's in quantum information before specializing into a graduate into my PhD. And so that's how I kind of stumbled into this field. And I think that with that extra training year, I fell in love with it.
So, I mean, in your case again, I mean, what's your focus? Is it more on the practical sound side, foundational side, experimental theory?
So I also work in quantum computing theory. My main project is working with Dan Brown and with a few other people as well on classical simulations of quantum circuits. But this project really kind of grew out of trying to think about how we can. So I'd say the kind of main theme of my research is thinking about how we can extract as much computational power as possible from intermediate scale quantum devices. We do have schemes for quantum computing which will be asymptotically optimal. We know we have asymptotically optimal compilers, for example, for single qubit gates out of Clifford plus T. But in the intermediate scale, I think it would be interesting to think about if we can kind of extract more, find some kind of resource savings, and do more computationally with our smaller devices by exploring just like a range of different schemes and different designs for realizing quantum computation.
So in this
So
particular, sorry, I mean, in this particular case, when you say neat term schemes, is this very sort of focused area of research at the moment into possible viable applications that don't necessarily require quantum error correction? They're small enough to get away with noisy devices.
I think I'm personally more interested in sort of thinking of early scale fault tolerant devices. So not this kind of noisy intermediate scale, but I'm using the term intermediate scale leadingly because it's what I want to say is like maybe the generation of devices that will supersede that. So we maybe have some degree of error correction, but we still have a small number of physical qubits, a kind of a limited number of gate operations we can do, and sort of. I'm interested in thinking of things like if we can, for example, choose alternative gate sets such as Clifford plus T to achieve circuits with smaller depth that have still nonetheless show like interesting quantum computational power, for example.
So, I mean, this must mean that QIP last week, I mean, I obviously didn't go personally, but I certainly looked over the schedule and I looked over the talks that were given. For both of you, this must have been a fairly good week because there was a lot of talks, as far as I could tell, and I'm assuming the same number of posters. Somewhat, I won't say evenly divided, but there was certainly good representation from both people working on error correction theory and also people working on these kind of intermediary applications for error-corrected quantum computing or even non-error-corrected quantum computing. So I don't know, either one of you, if you want to jump in, from both of your sides coming from respectively your each areas of research, what kind of work did you see that really sort of jumped out to you or sort of, you know, cut above the noise?
So, an interesting talk from me. Well, as we're both theorists, it's nice to see what's happening in experiments. So John Martinez has invited talk on the Wednesday morning, where he talked about the work that he's doing with Google with superconducting qubits. Was very interesting, and the sort of long-term goals that they have in terms of achieving a fault-tolerant surface code quantum computer.
Was that basically the focus of his discussion, or was it sort of on this supremacy 49 qubit chip that we've all heard so much about over the last 6 to 12 months?
So I think the main point he was trying to put across was that the quality is more important than quantity for early stage quantum computers. So yeah, you can put lots of qubits together and have a big headline that says, "Oh, we've achieved a 100 qubit quantum computer, and this is great," but it's not actually useful unless the actual qubits are any good.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all to do with thresholds that are required for quantum error correction codes to work. So this is the idea that you can make the performance of the quantum computer in terms of its error, logical error rate better by increasing the size of the quantum computer, but that'll only work if the individual components have error performance below a certain threshold themselves. So the first step is making sure that the individual qubits are very good, so making small systems that work before thinking about scaling up completely. So we were kind of hoping that he was going to announce a 50 qubit quantum computer, but
he did say it exists.
So this, but, I saw this certainly discussions that I saw, especially over Twitter and stuff like that. There's always somewhat of a bit of a confusion, especially when John Martinez talks, and when we see these press releases. I mean, they've been talking about a 21 qubit chip, and they've been talking about the 49 qubit chip, and I've seen various discussions about which one's in the fridge, which one's being tested, which ones are being fabricated, which ones do we have data for that we haven't published, etc., etc. Was there any sort of clarity to that? Which chip's in the fridge, which ones have been built, which ones have been tested, or was it still somewhat a little bit ambiguous?
So when he didn't really talk about actual specific devices as much in this talk, but when we were at, so Parak and I both went to the Quantum Error Correction Conference in September, which is similar to QIP, but specifically for quantum error correction and quantum computing.
This is the one in Baltimore, right?
The University of Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C.
Right.
And in that talk, he was giving some experimental results about some of the tests they'd done. Most of them were on the 9-qubit chip, I think. And he was talking about the 22-qubit chip that was currently in development. Between then and now, we've heard talk of this 50-qubit chip as well. So, you're right. It's not entirely clear working on, what's in production.
It certainly sounded to me like they have all three chips in the fridge. There was a lot of comments about testing the 49-qubit chip, which I think is mostly sort of calibrating each of the qubits, I imagine. But again, I mean, specifics, no, it was pretty light. And the only actual results that we saw were tests that were done, this, you know, nice Hofstadter butterfly simulation they've done with the 9-qubit device, which is... Yeah, so the actual data we saw was still from 9 qubits.
Right,
but
right.
It was ambiguous as to the state of the other two devices. It seems that they're in the fridge and that they're doing things with them, but we're not privy to that data just yet. But actually, I think between this talk and also the industry session on the afternoon, there was a surprising amount of discussion of like actual real world quantum computers at QIP this year, which was quite exciting, mm-hmm. I thought. Or at least, I mean, I recognize that would have been a bit the theme last year as well. But I think last year's conference did that. No, we had the IBM Quantum Experience, but I think since then the number of qubits that are available to us from all three of the main players at the moment, IBM, Rigetti, and Google, has gone up, at least. Well, Google don't make these available to us, but nonetheless, it's quite an exciting kind of playing field. And we even have, for example, like live demonstrations from the team at Rigetti, who are actually running programs on their 19-qubit device, live coding and then running those programs during the session, which was quite exciting, actually.
So, I mean, was it the industry session, I should say, or even the conference as a whole, was it limited to the superconducting space? Because obviously there are companies and industrial players out there doing ion traps, linear optics, diamond. Was it just basically focused on the superconducting guys?
From the industry players, yes. So yeah, as Mark said, we have Rigetti, which is a startup based in San Francisco, and then IBM and Google there. And they're all working on the superconducting transmon qubits. So there are other players like IonQ that are working on ion traps, but they weren't at this conference. Well, nobody was presenting that from IonQ that I saw. So yeah, it does seem as though the main thrust of the industrial effort at the moment is in superconducting qubits.
I mean, obviously you both were at the industry session, which, as far as I understood, was sort of allocated in the afternoon that usually at these kind of conferences sort of turn into a sightseeing or sort of touristy afternoon. And I certainly heard a few discussions from people as to, you know, at what point does sort of the industry sessions and these kind of forums for private sector players rather than academia, whether they're appropriate for these kind of conferences. And a lot of the back and forth I heard was about sort of the interest or the popularity of that session compared to, you know, the standard academic talk tracks that were occurring at the rest of the week. If both of you guys going, I mean, how did you feel sort of that was taken from the audience? Was it popular? Are there a few people in the room? What did people think of that sort of amalgamation between sort of the academic talks and the industry stuff?
Go ahead, Joshka.
I think as far as I could tell, in terms of the number of people in the audience, it was as popular as one of the first, one of the invited talks in the morning. I mean, if you actually want to program a quantum computer and you don't have one in your own lab at your own university, the only way of doing it nowadays is via one of these companies that's outsourcing their device. So yeah, from my perspective, it's one of the most interesting sessions of the conference to see how you could get access to this technology and a little more detail about how it works and what you can actually do with it. In addition to learning about some of the nice new quantum programming languages that are coming out. For example, Microsoft's new one, Q-Sharp, and Rigetti's Forest.
Yeah, I mean, I did quite enjoy the industry session, and anecdotally, I think most people I was speaking to at the conference did attend, mostly just because they were interested in having a chance to hear about what all these different industry players are up to, and sort of to, in some sense, it's nice to have a single session where you can sort of compare and contrast their approaches, see what their focus is, and have a bit of a sense of what they're working on at the moment. I do sort of understand. I think some of the criticism was sort of premised on this idea of private backers, sort of in some sense. I think someone described it as a private player sort of purchasing a plenary talk.
That was the main criticism.
Yeah, and I do understand that criticism. I mean, I sort of personally feel that given this is an afternoon that's usually free, I think people's attitude to it was you could sort of just view it as another afternoon of parallel sessions. Like either you have this industry session or you're free to go, you know, use the conference center, do some work, go have a look around the town and things. I mean, I know that to a certain extent, this is sort of like functioned similarly to a recruitment exercise or a publicity exercise for these groups. But at the same time, as Joshua says, like, these are some of the largest available sort of quantum devices that we have to run programs on. These, in some sense, these are the potential frameworks that could be used to control quantum computers of the future. And so I think it is nonetheless like relevant and interesting for us, even as theorists, to be aware of what these people are doing, because their actions, you know, play off academia. There's an interplay between industry and academia, and also they are, you know, trying to in some sense shape the future of this field, and it's good for us to understand, I think, their motivations and the kind of directions they see this going.
I mean, did you get a feeling, especially considering that both of you are fairly young within this industry, that there is a bit of a shift in sort of the audience, that people are getting into this, like, say, compared, I did my PhD, I started in 2003, compared to maybe my generation of grad sort of students, that maybe people are getting into this because it is starting to turn into an industry, and maybe that's what they're interested in looking at, rather than it necessarily being just a purely academic or lab-based kind of effort.
Yeah, it does seem as though there's, in terms of career options as well, or looking at what to do after a PhD, there does seem as though there is now plenty of opportunities in industry as well as in academia. So, yeah, I'd say that quantum computing has definitely escaped from universities, or escaped from being solely something that was researched in universities to something that is now taken pretty seriously by some very big technology companies, as well as lots of startups like Rigetti.
But I mean, I suppose I could be more direct to sort of ask, what do you guys think of this? I mean, when you guys entered your graduate degrees, was an academic career what it was? Or do you see now that, you know, maybe this training is a valuable asset to have in the industrial sector in 5 years or 10 years from now? And you don't envisage yourself to end up as full professors in the UK or wherever the hell you end up?
I mean, for me personally, an interest in quantum computing, I always did have in the back of my mind that this was maybe like a nearer term technology, and one of the sort of things that drew me to this field beyond sort of just particle physics was it sounds slightly ridiculous because we're still talking about quantum phenomena, but like a sense of tangibility, a sense of like, it's not, you know, what we're trying to do is to carefully control and exploit quantum systems and exploit this, like, and use this interesting behavior, this abstract behavior at the nanoscale to do powerful things. So that was definitely something that drew me to the field when I was thinking of going into it. I do sort of feel like the industrial aspect has taken off, even just in the, you know, this is my third year now as a graduate quantum computing student, and I do feel like the industry element has accelerated even just in that time. And it's certainly something that I didn't see being, when I first started this, you know, even, yeah, say 2 years ago, I didn't almost quite realize how big the industrial component could get. I saw something on Twitter from Earl Campbell the other day, for example, saying that he had a potential PhD applicant actually turn down a place because they had taken a job with a quantum computing company instead.
Yeah, I saw that.
That's something that I didn't even realize was a possibility, still, actually. So I am surprised, but it sort of retroactively makes me think that it is still important to have this industrial connection, because it's becoming part of the field. You know, there is research coming out of these industrial groups, and I think it's important for us to recognize that and stay up to date with what's happening.
But at the same time, there is also a lot of hype surrounding the development of quantum technology. So in one of the industry talks, Dave Bacon, who works at Google, showed us a nice plot where he'd looked at the Google search trends for quantum computing breakthroughs. And the number of times that news stories had announced there'd been some sort of quantum computing breakthrough. And it's been increasing every year. And already in 2018, we've had something like 150 quantum computing breakthroughs.
I saw an article in the Financial Times like 2 or 3 days ago where it's even now that the anticipated breakthroughs, which apparently is a replica of the same article they ran 12 months ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, certainly we're all, to a certain extent, very, very aware of the hype that's surrounding what's happening here. But, I mean, certainly from my point of view, I've been extremely happy with how this has developed and how this seems to be transitioning into more of an industry than necessarily just a sort of an academic subfield within physics. But certainly getting away from the industrial sessions at QIP, there was also a lot of stuff that I saw on the schedule just about sort of the basic stuff that you would see, but it seems, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed as though a lot of the talks were very much in line with sort of practical issues about quantum computing going into the next 5 years. You know, these kind of algorithms that could potentially be run without error correction. What can we do with these small devices that are starting to come out of whether it's industry groups or university-backed consortiums? How do we make things more efficient? You know, how do we make this more practical rather than potentially more fundamental ideas about, you know, quantum information theory, quantum systems, et cetera, et cetera? The schedule seemed to be very, very heavily focused on the next 5 or 6 years and making it practical. Is that assessment accurate?
I think there was a mix of both, really, because there are a lot of talks about specifically about achieving quantum advantage, which is the idea that you take a quantum computer and make it perform some problem that more efficiently than could be done on a classical computer, mm-hmm. just to show that quantum computers could potentially be better. So that doesn't necessarily mean quantum computer doing anything useful as such, just being better for a certain application. So there was this, so the first talk of the conference actually was by Robert Koenig. He was talking about quantum advantage with low-depth circuits, and he formulated some problem that he showed would be impossible to solve with a certain depth circuit on a classical computer, but could in principle be done on a near-term quantum device.
Mm-hmm.
When it but then on sort of covering more practical aspects, so Rui Shao from USC was talking about very practical aspects to do with quantum error correction, how to make the individual components within a quantum error correction code fault tolerant. He proposed this new scheme for syndrome extraction. So syndromes are the things that you measure to tell you what sorts of errors have occurred in your quantum computer when you encoded your information in the quantum error correction code.
Right.
But the extraction of those syndromes can often be very inefficient. But he proposed a method for making it much more efficient than existing techniques. So that's a sort of example of one of the sort of fundamental near-term problems that's being solved.
Yeah. I mean, I think, certainly I agree with Josh Grouchy. I think there was room for sort of both aspects of things. I think the sort of, in some sense, a lot of it actually would boil down to one half of the parallel session would be on these kind of sort of near-term questions. And the other half would be sort of more what you can kind of consider like maybe, yeah, foundational quantum information theory or quantum thermodynamics, for example, had quite a strong presence at the conference. And
yeah,
then there was also a session which was quite interesting. I think there was also, for example, one of the whole parallel sessions, I think, was actually looking at questions of the ADS-CFT correspondence and methods of like studying problems in this in quantum gravity using methods inspired by quantum error correction. So I think there was still room for sort of foundational sort of classical quantum information theory alongside the kind of more practical near-term problems, which were maybe the sessions that Joshka and I were attending. But yeah, I mean, I think that actually the conference did a really, really good job of striking a balance between these two sort of sides of the coin in some sense.
I mean, I'm certainly not implying that one has to give way to the other or vice versa. It's just more about, you know, certainly if you take even just a few years ago, as to whether or not even within the conference environment, within the quantum community, as to whether there seems to be a shift suggesting that this is becoming a thing. This is not just a research project anymore. You know, the entire goal of quantum technology or quantum computing research for the last 25-ish years has been about building these machines. And I mean, from your perspective, if you're seeing that maybe it is starting to shift in that direction, that, you know, even some of the more cynical people amongst us in the community are starting to think, well, geez, maybe we could actually do this.
Yeah, I would say so. I think there were some interesting sort of talks. As I say, there was a degree of, you know, there were speakers who advised a degree of caution. I mean, Joshua already talked about John Martinez's talk where he cautioned for the need to focus on qubit quality, not just qubit quantity. And certainly, for example, there was also a series of interesting talks on classical simulation, kind of pushing the bounds against quantum supremacy experiments. There was a really, really great talk on classical simulation algorithms for the boson sampling problem, for example, where using some sort of interesting techniques, we basically pushed the threshold, the number of sort of photons you need in your system for a boson sampling quantum supremacy experiment. That number has been pushed sort of like higher and higher. And so there is sort of a bit of a, you know, to a certain extent, you could interpret those talks cynically as kind of advising caution things. But I think I would say that the mood of the conference was optimistic that we're starting to enter this new era where we actually have small quantum devices where we can start to talk about, you know, demonstrating quantum advantage demonstrably, sort of, you know, proving, sort of having an experiment. You can conceptualize this as like an experimental proof of one of the sort of foundational ideas in quantum computing, which is the Church-Turing-Deutsch principle, right? And that would be quite an exciting point, I think.
I mean, maybe could you give, like, I don't know if it's possible for you to give like a 30-second of to what that is.
So I think the Church-Turing principle is obviously a statement about what kind of problems can be computed by a universal computing device. It's this class of functions called general recursive functions. But in his early sort of paper on quantum computing in the 80s, Deutsch proposed a slightly different idea, a different definition for what constitutes a universal computing device, which is a device that's capable of efficiently simulating physical systems. A classical computer fails this kind of so-called fails to satisfy this Church-Turing-Deutsch principle, and the kind of simple intuitive explanation as to why is that classical physics is continuous; it needs real numbers, but our classical computers are based on binary systems, and so we need an infinitely large binary string to encode an arbitrary continuous number. A quantum computer, however, which, you know, because we're using these physical systems as our units of computation, a quantum computer would be capable of simulating quantum physical systems. And so a universal quantum computer could serve as kind of a universal physical simulator and would satisfy this sort of Church-Turing-Deutsch principle. Mm-hmm. So the idea of what this is it sort of sets up a clear gap between the potential power of a classical and a quantum device. And sort of the motivation for a quantum supremacy experiment is in the real world, provably doing some kind of computational task faster with a quantum computer than we could with a classical one, and some people sort of conceptualize this as demonstrating this gap in ability between the two devices, which we expect to exist.
And I mean, this is obviously the thing that we hear about in the media all the time at the moment is this, mm-hmm. you know, supremacy experiments, whether it's from Google, IBM, whoever happens to get there first. As far as I can tell from what you guys have said earlier, that there's starting to be a little bit of pushback on that, or, you know, the skepticism that's always been there has started to bubble up a little bit more seriously to the surface.
I think, so from terms of getting funding and the like, this sort of effort is very important because sort of tangible proof that a quantum computer is better than a classical computer is necessary if we're going to proceed. I think One area that was actually omitted from or didn't seem to be very well represented at QIP was adiabatic quantum computation. So this is another way of building a quantum computer that depends upon continuous evolution of the Hamiltonian that controls the system, as opposed to sort of discrete application of Hamiltonians to form a gate set that you can then construct a universal gate set from to perform quantum computation in the fault tolerant manner, which is what we see with the quantum computers that we've been talking about for the up until now in this discussion. Up until the last couple of years, when IBM and Google and Rigetti have been starting working on superconducting qubits, pretty much the only quantum computer that anybody had ever heard of outside of quantum computing research was D-Wave, and they were working on one of these continuous time quantum computers, specifically quantum annealing. In terms of the tasks that they're suited to solve, it's a little different in that they're specifically tailored towards optimization problems. But in terms of which computer will be the first to demonstrate some sort of quantum advantage, I think this case is still out there that it could be one of these adiabatic quantum computers solving some sort of optimization problem rather than a circuit-based computer solving one of these quantum advantage problems that have been specifically constructed just to show an advantage.
Do you see that there's much of a distinction? I mean, there's obviously a whole different way you can, well, not different way, but there are several ways you can look at this. I mean, you can look at a problem that's physically interesting within the physics community. You can look at a problem that's just about, in the case, say, for example, of these supremacy protocols, whether it's boson sampling or these other protocols that have been demonstrated, just simply proving that you can do something better than you could ever do classically. And then there's the third category, which is are we going to be able to develop something somebody's going to pay for? Was there much of a distinction between these three things, especially since, as far as I can tell, there were quite a few talks about like algorithmic development? I mean, what was your feeling from this? Was it about physics for physics' sake? Was it about simply getting to these points where you can say, we definitely have built a machine that can do something quantum that is better than classical? Or was it about, okay, what can we build that we're going to sell?
I would say all three were represented, though the last point I think maybe wasn't presented in those kind of terms. Certainly, I was actually quite, I don't work in quantum algorithms, but I was actually, it's not a field that I really follow, but I was quite interested to see the amount of actual like work on developing concrete quantum algorithms that was presented at QIP, and that was actually quite exciting to see in terms of just giving us a wider range of applications. I mean, I've always felt that, you know, there is more to quantum computing than just Grover and Shor. and that was certainly something I think that was borne out at QIP this year. But there were also, I think, you know, a good number of talks on doing physics simulations with quantum computing, which were not just for physics' sake. A lot of them were grounded in asking questions about quantum chemistry and materials science as well. And also, as I say, a good few talks on the questions of supremacy, as I said, those were more from the perspective of classical algorithms examining these kind of sort of computer science problems basically questioning our definitions of the field and pushing the boundaries, the envelope as to where that sort of classical to quantum transition lies. But nonetheless, like, I think all three points were pretty well represented at the conference.
I suppose that's a good indication that that things are being reasonably covered, considering the kind of work that everyone's doing at this point. We could easily focus on one of those three or even more categories. But I mean,
yeah,
certainly as we get back, or as we get towards the end of this podcast, I'd like to pull it back to both of you personally. Given your own fields of research, I mean, was there anything that you saw at QIP that either you think can be integrated to your own work, or makes you want to step back for a second and say, hang on, maybe there's something interesting down this pathway that I think that I could follow.
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose the most useful part of the conference in terms of collecting ideas and talking to people was a poster session. So yeah, I spoke with various people about issues to do with quantum error correction specifically making small codes for near-term devices. So codes to be put on computers like the IBM chip and potentially the Rigetti one, although the connectivity on that one is not quite as good as some of the small IBM one. Although there's still some potential to do interesting things. But yeah, it was just a very useful conference in that respect, especially the poster session.
Yeah, for my part, actually, probably one of my favorite parts of the conference was what I've sort of taken to calling the Clifford session, which was this little one of the parallel sessions, which just had a few talks on just the Clifford group. There was a talk from a student of Scott Aronson's on basically ways of classifying the Clifford group into sort of disjoint subsets based on the universal gate set, based on the gates, the unitary gates that you can generate with those subsets. And there was also the second talk on basically an analog of the Schur-Weil duality using Clifford group unitaries. And both of these were just really, really interesting for a few reasons. Both, one sort of in terms of actual mathematics, this sort of curious gate called the T4 or the anti-identity gate. It's basically, if you just did a bitwise XOR of all the entries in the identity gate, you get this T4 gate, which is one I've never come across before, but which featured quite heavily in both talks. But certainly also both of them introduced a huge range of ideas and applications for basically problems, a huge range of ideas that could be applied to a whole bunch of problems in quantum error correction, in studying things like stabilizer states and which I sort of use in my work on classical simulation of quantum circuits, questions have to do with state testing and questions to do with like state preparation as well, and these kind of verification protocols. It was a really, really interesting session just because of the sort of the density of like new ways these two techniques which can be applied in a huge number of ways. I thought that for me was probably the most exciting part of the conference. It sounds like quite a dry session, but actually there was a lot of really interesting ideas there that could be used. Yeah.
So, I mean, the last thing I want to ask both of you, especially since you're both located in the UK, I mean, are you both members of the hubs?
UCL, I think it does not. Is not a strictly a member of the hub, but we do have research collaborations with researchers from most of the UK hubs. Durham is, I think.
So we're tangentially related to one of the hubs, the NKIT hub. So mm-hmm. We've collaborated with people working on that. In fact, one of the postdocs in our group, Dominic Horstman, used to work in the Oxford group that was working on problems to do with NKIT and then moved here. So yeah, we've had some collaborations through here.
Yeah, I suppose the reason that I'm asking is to try and maybe just have a few comments about the UK's place as you guys see it within what's happening, especially in the last, say, 12 months, when you take into account what's happening in the EU, with regards to the flagship program, when you're talking about, say, what the Chinese are doing with the quantum satellites and basically everything else that's happening in China with quantum technology, with all of this industry investment, whether it's the traditional companies like Google, Microsoft, IBM, or whether it's things like these massive investments that are coming about through Alibaba, this latest Swedish investment in building a quantum center in Stockholm, if I'm correct. Do you see the UK engaging and potentially being, you know, one of these major players within sort of the quantum technology sphere or the quantum computing sphere?
Well, yes, I'd hope so. So if you look at the commitment that went to creating the quantum technology hub in terms of the amount of money spent, I think it was over £250 million just for the UK, which when you put that into perspective, the I think the EU quantum technology program for the entire EU was £1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So for the UK alone, we've had £250 million invested. Yes, there has been a lot of money going into quantum technology, and yeah, I can only hope that that level of interest is retained, especially with all the potential problems coming up with Brexit and the like. So yes, what I hope is that that will not mean that the UK is excluded from European research, scientific research funding programs. And if it is, for whatever reason, then I can only hope that the UK government makes up the difference, but that will remain to be seen, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's still a lot of questions around the future of the future relationships between the UK and the EU in terms of science funding. I think at the moment the commitment is to continue with funding through till 2020, which means that we can benefit from some of those sort of the European flagship initiatives. I know that at UCL actually a sort of collaboration between my supervisor Dan Brown, along with Earl Campbell, Barbara Terhel, and a couple of other researchers have been awarded a grant as part of the Quantera program, which is this basically the European project which looks at setting up networks of quantum computing research across the UK. So one of those networks, QCDA, is going to have a node based at UCL, and another node based in Sheffield. And this is, I think one of the sort of larger networks actually successfully funded under the program. So I think that it still shows that there is a potential for the UK at the moment, at least, is still, we are still collaborating with people within Europe. We're still benefiting from this kind of network of funding and collaboration. UCL also, I think, I mean, we're not part of the hub program, but we do have quite a significant investment in quantum technologies. So I'm doing my PhD as part of the EPSRC Center for Doctoral Training. That program is in its fourth year now, which means there are about over 40 of us now, graduate students all working and getting extra master's year of training and working in quantum computation. So I think certainly like UCL is a real hub of activity in quantum technologies at the moment, and that's not something that's going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, I think if you look at there was a summer school for students in quantum information science that was hosted by Imperial College. I think it happens every year. And when I went to it, and so it's specifically for first year PhD students. And I think there are about 50 people there, so 50 students per year, just in the UK, doing PhDs in quantum information. So there is a lot of interest both from the perspective of government funding and from students wanting to do it, which is a promising sign.
So I suppose the last thing that maybe people would want to take away from this discussion, especially from your guys' perspective, since you're doing PhDs at the moment, is, do you see it as being, not just in an intellectual sense, but in sort of a practical sense for your careers and your lives as something that is still an encouraging thing and maybe even getting a more encouraging thing to sort of push people into, that it's not, this is moving to being an industry. You want to be trained in this industry and, but basically would you recommend this kind of stuff to people who are coming through undergrad or even going down as low as the high school level?
I would absolutely recommend working in quantum technologies. I think it's an exciting field which is moving really, really quickly and developing quickly. And I think there's a great potential for people to get involved and to sort of apply. I think what's especially nice about it is it applies a whole range of, it is such an interdisciplinary field. You know, there are elements of just pure mathematics, physics, experimental physics, and also computer science as well. And I think that's something that makes it, I feel like sort of whatever your interests are in science and technologies, you can find a way to explore those through quantum information. So definitely something I would recommend for people.
Yeah, I would agree. I was far excited. It's a subject that covers a lot of different disciplines. And there's pretty much something for, if you come from a science background, there are exciting things to do in terms of quantum applications and or quantum experiments, algorithm design, that could apply to a wide range of fields. And it's all cutting edge stuff at the moment, with the potential to grow massively in the coming years. So I definitely recommend any undergraduates who are thinking about what they might want to do next, to look into quantum technology.
So it's safe to say that both of you think that, you know, it's not going to get to the end of your PhD and you're going to sit there in your bedroom going, geez, what am I going to do now?
I mean, even if you don't work specifically in quantum technology, as because of the fact it's such a interdisciplinary field, you'll have picked up a lot of skills that are useful in other places of work. So I don't think you need to worry about the fact that if quantum computing turns out not to work, if somebody comes up with some no-go theorem that says that quantum computers will never achieve quantum advantage, and it's all been a waste of time, you'll still have a useful skill set or many other things. That's nothing to worry about whatsoever.
So, I mean, finally, before we end on today's podcast, because it's already been nearly 55 minutes, is there anything happening either at Durham or UCL that you guys want to plug or feel would be interesting for people to know about?
I think we were, there was talk of so something that Parag and I will be involved in is a quantum error correction, a UK quantum error correction sort of workshop that will be happening in April. So if anybody's interested in coming to talk to us about quantum error correction and other things to do with quantum computing, I think get in contact with us or Earl Campbell, who's the person organizing it, because it would be good to get everybody in the UK quantum error correction community together at some point.
Yep. Just slightly different. Obviously, that's more for people who are currently working and researching in the field. I mean, just in terms of if there are students listening to this who are interested in quantum computing, but feel like they want to get more training in the field before they start to pursue a PhD. Again, I think UCL is reopening applications for this Center for Doctoral Training. So this is the program that I'm on, and I think the great thing about it is that the first year is a taught master's, so you have a chance to explore fields a range of fields from quantum information to actually experimentally building quantum devices and also quantum computing and quantum communication, which then culminates in the research project, which, you know, a 12-week research project that forms the basis of your future PhD. And I think this is a really good way to basically dip your toes into the field and learn more about it before you make the sort of scary decision of committing to a 3 or a 4 year PhD project. So if you're interested, certainly if you're interested in quantum computing, do look at the UCL Center for Doctoral Training in delivering quantum technologies.
Wonderful. So both of you, thanks for giving me an hour of your time and thanks for basically a great chat about both what you're both looking at and what happened in Delft last week with QIP. So thanks again for coming on the podcast.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Wonderful. So thanks everyone again for downloading this episode. As usual, subscribe to either the podcast or follow us on Twitter for updates about when our next episodes are going to be. As I promised late last year, I will try to make them more regular than I did in 2017. And again, thanks for joining us. Cheers.